Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. Today, my name's Tracy. I'm here with Rob, one of our Booktopians, and we're here with the author of Jim's book, Catherine Mullinshot, and we have Jim Penman, the subject of the book, with us. So thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you, and it's really exciting to see the book and see such a story of, you know, everyone knows the Jim's Mowing brand, and it's nice to have the real story behind it. What inspired you to write the book?
Well, I think I met Jim. Jim was speaking at a business event, and I was quite interested to, you know, talk to him, someone obviously who's achieved a lot. And from there, he discovered what I do, kind of in my normal day job, I guess you could say. I have my own business where I help different CEOs and professionals write their own books and things.
She did a TED talk, which is really good, so I like that.
I like what she said.
Yeah,
so I have a TEDx. It's like on living the funnel of greatness, which is this concept that Jim really resonated with. And anyway, we got talking, and kind of after a few different meetings and things, it basically came out where Jim was like, you know what, it'd be kind of interesting to have a biography that's truly warts and all, and if you're wanting to take it on, I can introduce you to people who like me and who really, really don't like me, so that you can get that really balanced opinion of me and my life story. And I was stoked to be able to have an opportunity to write about, obviously, someone who's done so much, so it all started from there.
I have to say, the book is very, very engaging. I picked it up and I'm just reading through some of the beginning of it, and I'm laughing out loud. And it's not one of those dry, boring business biographies. So
it's engaging to me too, actually. There's a lot of stuff I didn't even know. A whole lot of things used to go on that Catherine found out. They seem to talk to her in a way that I've never been able to.
Some of the franchisors and things in the early days.
It was a bit of a shock.
Well, I think a lot of this will be a surprise a lot of Australians, because as much as we know the brand, and I think the brand is quite iconic in Australia, I didn't know a great deal about you before Wiley presented the book to me.
Well, the most common question our franchisees get asked is there really a Jim? The single most common question.
I was asked that this morning.
I've been asked that. Is there really a Jim?
It's philosophical,
said, yes,
doesn't it?
And she said, have you met him?
What did you say?
Nothing. I just smiled and walked away. I don't usually say, tell people who I am in public.
Yeah, I mean, your success in the business and having so many different franchises and so many different aspects, I mean, it's mind-boggling to think that all the services across your group started from a man with a lawnmower, in effect.
Yes. Well, the thing I find most amazing about my career is that with all the stupid mistakes I've made and all the weaknesses that I've got, it's actually worked out okay, at least so far.
I think it proves that, you know, if you want to do something, you can overcome anything, basically.
But it proves you don't have to be good at everything.
Yeah.
Because a lot of things I'm not very good at.
Yeah.
But very poor people skills and so forth, which comes out in the book in a whole lot of ways. Catherine really got that one out. A lot of examples, isn't there?
Yeah, there were quite a few examples of that.
So what was the thing that surprised you most about Jim undertaking writing this book?
It was a very interesting experience writing the book. You know, obviously, Jim is someone who a lot of people really like and really respect, and I found those people who know him quite closely, I feel quite strongly about that. And then I also found that there were some other staff who might be more distant. You know, some of the people who know him would explain stuff that don't deal with Jim every day, being very fearful of him. So, and then, of course, I met people who really enjoyed going on about things that they really, really dislike about Jim and past business dealings or things that have happened. And so it was a very intriguing process, but I think what I enjoyed the most was that Jim is someone who is so surprising, and it is such an unusual story. Like, I think I'm used to that entrepreneurial story of this gung-ho person who just always, you know, almost like an Elon Musk, like always takes on this insane amount of risk that you could never imagine doing yourself, and somehow is worth multi-millions when they're 29. And Jim is someone who isn't very, as you say, slightly socially awkward, or, you know, he doesn't have that same kind of charismatic personality. And he's someone who's just consistently worked and worked and worked and worked, and over the past 30 years has built a mammoth franchise that everyone in Australia knows, with some principles really around it, looking after franchisees and customers really, really well. So, he's an interesting personality that doesn't disappoint. There's a lot of odd quirks and different things that you'll discover in the book, but also ultimately what he's built, I think, is deeply impressive and inspiring.
That's one of the things that stood out for me, about your care for the actual franchisee, because a lot of franchise systems don't necessarily put the franchisees first. Having worked for a few different ones and seen the struggles of the owners of those businesses, why was it so important to you to make your group and your franchise system so much fairer towards the franchisee?
Well, it's an emotional thing as much as anything else. When I started gyms as a franchise, well, first of all, when I started Lawnmowing, it was just something to do while I got something better to do with my life. And then 7 years later, after I started full-time mowing, I launched the franchise, and somebody asked me, how many franchisees do you think you might have one day? And I said, if it really goes well, maybe 100. I just didn't have any concept of
how... I'm just going to say there's almost 4,000 now, just to put that into perspective.
But I just had this, thing from the beginning. For example, I made the decision right from the beginning that I wasn't going to pick as a franchisee anybody that I thought was had a significant chance of failure.
Yeah.
I would send all my new franchisees out on the road with established, experienced people I trusted, and I said, have a look at them. If they're not good, I won't take them. Now, I thought that was probably a dumb thing to do financially because I was losing potential franchisees. But what I've come to realise that actually, in fact, by being selective, it caused the business to grow further because it creates a better environment. The franchisees tend to be more positive. The brand is better. You have more work comes through and this kind of thing. So a lot of this, most of the best decisions I made in my business were decisions that were based on doing the right thing that looked like a bad thing idea financially. Yeah. And I think that kind of conflict between people who look to the money first don't do nearly as well as somebody who looks to, you know, looking after the customer first or the franchisee first. And if you've got that first in your mind, the money will tend to come.
Yeah. It's a philosophy that is resonated big with Booktopia. Everything that Tony Nash and his family have done about building this business has been towards what can we do for the customer, what put the customer first, you know. So it's so important. And I think that's why there's so much trust in the gym's brand in Australia.
I've been reading a book about Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook, and of course I'm not comparing, he's about a million times more capable than I am, but he had the same attitude. He had a lot of fights in the early days with people in the company because he was always after the best customer experience, and they kept on saying, no, we want more money, and he said, no, money is secondary. Let's get the growth first. Even though they were losing money, we just got to have the best possible experience for our people.
Yeah.
And don't worry about anything else, and then the money will come, and of course it has. It's that same attitude, and it's often an emotional driver. It's like when I was mowing lawns, it wasn't so much that I thought if I do a good job I'll get more customers and I'll make more money. It's I have to do a good job because it's really offensive to me to do anything less than a great job.
Yeah.
I hated letting people down. I hated seeing a job less than perfect, and it was that emotional drive more than the desire for money that made my mowing business successful. And the same thing with franchising. Yeah. And that's a kind of a lesson that I hope people would learn from my career. You don't have to be incredibly capable. And you certainly don't have to be smart financially, but you've got to have a passion for what you do and the people you deal with.
Yeah, no, I agree. Passion and is so important. And so many of the greatest businesses that we see around the world have been built on passion, that drive to do something.
It's like Ray Kroc going into the area around the McDonald's in the early days and picking up the rubbish and dumping it on the desk. He was just angry. I mean, it was silly. This guy's a billionaire.
Yeah.
A bit of rubbish about it, so cares. But to him, it was far more than just making money. It was the fact that this was offensive to him. Or Bob James, he used to go ballistic if somebody had grass in the car park. These guys were immensely rich, but they cared about what they did.
I read in the book that you still keep an eye on the customer complaints and
any customer that rings twice. If the problem when a customer rings once, it goes to the franchisee and the franchisor. Mm-hmm. They normally would handle it. If the customer rings back a second time, it comes straight to me. Every staff member at the call centre knows that it comes straight to me, and I will sit on that until it's fixed. no matter what it costs, no matter how long it takes.
There's a good story, actually, because one of the staff members who I interviewed, in his first few months of working for Jim, a customer, there was, you know, an issue with a customer, and it was a bit of a complicated issue, but anyway, he basically jumped in and went to solve things and organised what to happen, and he was absolutely shocked when, I think about half an hour later, Jim found out. It was a situation where normally Jim would step in. And Jim found out, and then Jim stepped in and went absolutely, was very upset, and he was like, I thought I was about to lose my job. And he said it was insane that he felt like he was about to lose his job over helping a customer when normally a CEO wouldn't care about stepping in. You know, they wouldn't be the ones who would step in and do it first. Obviously. And he said that Jim called the customer and said, hi, it's Jim, so what are we going to do? And the person was like, what? Sorry, is this Jim? yes, this is the Jim. So what we're going to do is that he'll just move on with the solution. But you can imagine for a customer when you're having actually Jim Penman call you to solve an issue. I'm sure they were quite ecstatic.
That would be, it's almost unheard of in most businesses. CEO wouldn't even know who their customers are.
I mean, every single one of my franchisees has my direct phone number and email address. I tell them not to give the phone number, especially to outsiders, but any one of them can contact me at any time about any subject, and I'll always respond to them.
That's impressive. I mean, yeah. But how do you fit it all in? I mean, you started with the Jim's Mowing, and then you've added more and more franchise
divisions.
Okay. How many divisions do you have now?
Just about 50. But though, mind you, the difference isn't very much, really. Yeah. Whether you're mowing or cleaning or dog wash, they're very similar at the franchising level.
Yeah.
In fact, the head of our dog wash division is a brilliant lady. She's never washed a dog in her life, as far as I know. She's very good at looking after franchisees and marketing and helping people be successful and all the things you need to do to be a great franchisor. Look, one of my great secrets in business is that I'm actually fairly incompetent. I'm not very good at doing a lot of things. So I find people who are good at them and let them get on with their job. And I just do the relatively few things that I can do quite well. So, yeah. If I was better at doing stuff, I'd probably do it myself and then I'd have the time.
Yeah, you probably wouldn't get as far as you had if you had to do it all yourself. It's, employing the right people and allowing them to...
I make a lot of mistakes. One of the things you'll see in there is that people say, I trust the wrong people, don't I?
Yeah, there were... Well, a lot of people would say that Jim trusts very quickly, and sometimes the judgment might be often they think he's trusting the wrong person. Yeah. Other people... Our valued staff members who've been around for 5, 10, 15, even up to 20 years, and they were trusted from the get-go, and obviously they have a strong relationship there and appreciate that trust, but the number did say that Jim's a bit too trusting. His judgment is sometimes a bit off.
It tends to bring out, I've made some terrible mistakes and lost a lot of money by doing that. At the same time, when you've got somebody who's good, when you trust them and you give them a lot of freedom, it actually brings out the best in people. One of the things that came out of Catherine's interview, which was very heartwarming, is that they're mostly fairly positive. They don't just work for wages, my staff.
A lot of the staff were exceptionally passionate and positive. And I think Jim really does put the franchisee first. And he does put the franchisee almost as a whole and as a group first. So if there's one franchisee who isn't doing a good job, Jim will... There's a due process, but they will be terminated if they're just not doing a good job, because that's putting all the franchisees at risk. So sometimes... some people who were more negative, shall we say, would say, oh, yeah, you know, he says he puts the franchisees first, but does he actually? But Jim, as a group, always puts the franchisees first. And that message is ultimately inspiring, and the staff clearly find that inspiring, because Jim genuinely, passionately gets very emotionally upset if they're not looked after and cares about them very deeply. So as a whole.
I don't think staff basically want to work as a life's mission to make their boss rich. It's not a particularly... ennobling thing, but service to people. We help, you know, like 4,000 families, because including workers and so forth, there'd be a lot more than that, to be successful. It makes an enormous difference to their lives and the way their children are brought up. It's like a mission, and I think most of my staff feel that way, that we're doing something really valuable and worthwhile, that we're really helping people a lot.
That's great. And I mean, I think it shows in the trust that Australia has with the brand. But so many people are afraid of making mistakes, but you learn so much from making those mistakes that often, even though, you might lose some money, you actually gain more in other ways when you are not afraid to make those mistakes. that
yeah, well, I've made so many.
He has made some pretty funny ones.
Oh, even last year I made a couple of appalling mistakes which cost me a lot of money. I mean, it's just, it keeps on going. It never seems to stop. My wife goes apoplectic about me sometimes. She just says, you're so reckless. Why do you do that? Why don't you listen?
Jim's insanely willing to experiment and just dive into something without necessarily doing a due diligence into the industry or anything.
I'm trying to get better advice these days and try and calm myself down, but I don't know.
But that's what's gotten you to this point, is being that willingness to have a go. And I think it's an admirable quality rather than a...
Yeah.
You know. Certainly creates an interesting story, that's for sure.
You say you were surprised by some of the things in the book. Have you learnt things that you've gone and changed?
Well, the business about... I try to listen to this thing about trusting the wrong people. I think I've learnt that lesson better. It was certainly enlightening in a whole lot of different ways. It was just a shock. I mean, generally more positive. People were more positive than I thought they would be.
Yeah.
Honestly, that was a surprise. That's nice to know. And I guess that helps me to deal with people in a way that's more... I try and recognise... I'm not always good at recognising people's... They're doing things well. I really try and say, you know, well done, and that's been great, or appreciate that suggestion. I think it's helped me that way. Understanding how loyal my staff are. I'm incredibly blessed by my staff. I mean, I know we talk about franchisees first and stuff, but in reality, staff are incredibly important, and you've got to look after staff and, you know, what makes somebody happy and,
yeah,
and why do they want to put everything they've got into the job? That makes so much difference. And it's not only money. In fact, it's not even mainly money. There's people who come to work for me who are making far more in their previous job. But they like the environment.
I think feeling a part of something bigger and that you're valued is such a huge incentive for anyone. Yes, money is nice, but at the end of the day, it doesn't make you happy to go to work if you hate your colleagues or you hate the job that you're doing. So.
One of Jim's staff quoted Jim as being a tough but fair boss, and he said that about 20 times in that interview, and I think that probably sums it up quite well. Tough but fair.
Did you have any problem getting people to talk about Jim for the book?
Yeah, there were a few. For instance, his three ex-wives all refused, unfortunately, as much as I tried to get in contact with them, which is fair enough. Obviously, in my position, it was quite interesting because there's some people who I so wanted to interview. Also, you know, there was a court case that happened with a family called the Thorntons, and I really wanted to get their side of the story, and they also just totally refused. And you have to respect someone doing that. Sometimes it would frustrate me because I'm like, here's your opportunity to, you know, I want to hear your side of the story. I want to share both. I want to share what actually happened. And if you refuse to speak to me, that just means I can't because I don't have that information from you. So sometimes I felt like I wish they had, and maybe I felt like they were shooting themselves in the foot maybe a little bit, but of course I'm biased because I just really wanted to talk to them. I totally understand them not wanting to talk to some random girl claiming she's writing some biography. You know what I mean? So I get that. But it was an interesting process. There were definitely some really, you know, it was very exciting at times to get hold of someone and get to talk to them who I hadn't expected to be able to. And then there were a few others that, you know, I really would have loved to sit down with, but unfortunately they weren't willing to.
I gave her the full list of everybody that hates me, so which is quite a few people.
Yeah.
And all the contact details and everything I could. And I wrote things guaranteeing that...
quite a few people asked Jim to sign a legal document promising not to sue... promising not to sue them for anything that they told me. So Jim was literally willing to write these legal documents saying, yep, I promise so-and-so I won't sue you for anything you tell Catherine Woolenscott. So that was quite an interesting experience, just let alone having to do that to interview some people. So that was quite interesting.
But I thought it had to have some integrity as a book.
Yeah.
And like I said, I mean, if it was me writing it, I wouldn't have written it that way. But at the same time, you know...
And there are
multiple sides to any situation, and people see... mean people in different ways, and there should be a like that's to me, that's journalism.
Mm. Yeah.
It's got integrity. There was a book about Elon Musk, which both of us have read, which is a good model for that. I mean, it's written by somebody who was given all of access, but certainly he put the naysayers in, or someone like Steve Jobs too.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not putting myself on their level, but a credible book has to be balanced. It can't just be a hagiography, or it's not.
Yeah.
Not much fun.
Yeah, it's not fun reading a one-sided account of anyone's life, because no one is perfect.
And it was quite an interesting experience to also figure out how to put so many, you know, I interviewed over 100 people. So how do you piece together an honest account from and some of them, you know, it's 100 different opinions on who Jim is, plus his opinion on who he is. And one of the things that was interesting was Jim was one of the only ones who never said, this is off the record, or no, you can't ask me that. I was allowed to ask him anything and we could go anywhere. But, you know, there were other interviewees who would tell me things, oh, but this is off the record. And as much as I would want to put something in the book, they would want to withhold it for some reason. So it was an interesting process to gather so many opinions and try and really make sure it was a well-rounded, honest account. But I did my best, and hopefully people enjoyed it.
A lot of material for this, because, I mean, to get it down to, what is it, through like 270 pages or something?
That was a lot of work.
You're probably getting about 2% of what you actually got, isn't it, in the end?
Yeah, well, I won't even go into the word count, but I originally it was much bigger, and I had to bring it down to really make sure I was sharing everything that I think the Australian public will really find interesting.
And how long was this process?
I started on the 1st of January last year.
Wow.
Which is interestingly specific, yeah.
It's actually fairly short
time.
Yeah.
Very short. To get to publication for just over a year. Yeah.
I worked quite hard.
Undertaking.
Yeah. Well, I don't think Catherine did much else last year, did you?
No.
But I have to say the end result is highly engaging. It's a really enjoyable read, and I think Australia's going to receive it very, very well. And
thank you.
We're looking forward to seeing it being out there in the world and seeing how people react to it.
So much.
Thank you so much for both of you coming in. It's been great talking to you and meeting you. And if anyone wants a copy, they can order it now on booktopia.com.au. We'll have limited signed copies available. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.